and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Federal Reserve's announcement that it is ending its $4.5 trillion quantitative easing program started 6 years ago to help Wall Street recover from the 2008 economic crisis it caused by buying bonds. Robert Johnson, the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, who was formerly the chief economist at both the United States Senate Banking Committee and the United States Senate Budget Committee, joins us to assess how the global markets will react, and in particular, the record high U.S. stock market, which has been the beneficiary of investors looking for higher returns because of record low interest rates. Then we'll look into the impending sabotage by hawks in Congress, whose ranks will be swelled by the expected Republican takeover of the Senate, of the P5 plus one agreement President Obama is likely to sign with Iran in late November. Dr. Trita Parsi, the co-founder and the president of the National Iranian American Council, joins us to discuss his article at Reuters, How Congressional Hawks Plan to Kill Obama's Iran Deal, and examine the window of opportunity that congressional hawks, who appear to be in coordination with Israel's prime minister, have to kill the Iran deal before it bears fruit and shows how much it is working because of pent-up demand inside Iran for normal relations and the eagerness to do business with the U.S. once sanctions are lifted. Then finally, we will speak with Kim Lane Shapil, a expert on Hungary, who is a professor of sociology and international affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School and director of the program in law and public affairs at Princeton University. We'll discuss huge demonstrations in Hungary against the increasingly authoritarian right-wing government of Prime Minister Viktor Orban, whose government wants to introduce an internet tax and levy a fee on every gigabyte of internet data transferred. This has prompted thousands across the political spectrum to take to the streets and hurl all computer parts at the headquarters of the ruling Fidesz party. And joining us now is Robert Johnson, the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a senior fellow and director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz and was chief economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the United States Senate Budget Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Johnson.
Nice to be here.
And the U.S. Federal Reserve has just announced that its $4.5 trillion quantitative easing program, which has been in effect for more than 5 years, is about to end. In fact, Janet Yellen said they'd cease buying bonds this month. Is that meaning October or November?
I believe at the end of October, which is this coming weekend, is when they conclude their buying program. They've been telegraphing that for some time. So I don't think it came as a real surprise to the markets, but it is a symbolic step after many, many months over many years, starting from the back in the beginning of the crisis, that extraordinary measures, extraordinary asset purchases are being brought to a halt. At one level, one should say, while not being, how I say, jumping the starting gun, that this is good news. It's just symptomatic that the central bank thinks that the economy is returning to a more normal state. I particularly would think senior citizens who are savers would like to get on with it and earn something again in their savings accounts, like we were. You know, we were once quite habituated to earning 3-4% on savings, and now people are just consuming their principal, and that's very hard on retirees. So I think that there's a lot to be said there, and the Fed was also very careful to say, don't look for us to raise interest rates anytime soon. The labor market still is not strong enough.
But clearly this will affect the stock market, won't it? That's why people have gone to the stock market, surely.
Well, my sense is it can have two impacts on the stock market. The first impact comes from just higher interest rates, so there's, you know, other things to do with your money. If the Fed's not buying the bonds, maybe you can buy the bonds, and that works better. But the other side of it is, if the Fed's feeling confident that the economy's getting stronger, one might imagine that in the medium term, we're going to see stronger earnings, and stronger profits, more dividends, and things of that nature. But it's all tricky. The stock market's tricky. It's not just one unified thing, because if the dollar's stronger, right now the Europeans are about to start quantitative easing. The Japanese are hitting the accelerator real hard, and they have a meeting come up November 1st while the U.S. is withdrawing it. If this causes the dollar to continue to strengthen, and it's strengthened several percent against Europe this year, that may hurt the earnings of U.S. export companies. So stock market can have a very mixed reaction. Bond market is somewhat clear. The bond markets are likely to sell off a bit.
Well, people have been putting their money in the United States in spite of the almost zero interest rate. So if the interest rates go up, wouldn't one assume that more money would come in? And that would...
It depends on lots of things. If the money's coming in because of health, meaning the economy's becoming more vital and supports a larger interest rate and spurs investment demand, you're exactly right. Alternatively, money may flow in because what you might call we're the least ugly winner of the beauty contest. Things may not be good here, but they're getting worse in China, worse in Japan, significantly worse in Europe. And so everything is pushed towards the United States as the, which you might call the lesser of evils.
So one of the only virtues, as far as I could tell, Rob Johnson, of the low interest rates, which we've had for such a long time, would have been if the United States had invested in its failing and crumbling infrastructure. I mean, it's been an incredibly ripe time, has it not, to fix what needs to be fixed in this country. So are we going to lose that opportunity? Not that the Republicans have allowed anybody, and I'm not even sure the Democrats have really made a case for it, to do so.
Well, there's an old saying, penny wise and pound foolish, and I don't care which party you're in. When you're allowing the infrastructure in the United States of America to atrophy, someday you're going to have to pay $3 to repair to replace what you could have repaired and maintained for $1. So I think it's foolhardy. And as you mentioned, with the low credit costs we've had, the low interest rates for a long period of time, we could have built a lot of infrastructure, created more jobs, and got out of this hole, this long, prolonged slump, much, much sooner.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on the International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz and was Chief Economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. So, in terms of what the Fed's been buying, though, in this quantitative easing program, the $4.5 trillion that they've been buying as a result of the 2008 crash, and that, of course, that 2008 crash was the greatest transfer of private debt into public debt, I think, in the history of the world. Do we know the nature? Were they buying up toxic assets to get Wall Street off the hook?
Well, I guess the way they would look at it was not just a simple transfer to Wall Street, though people are rightly, which Michael, suspicious that financial regulators are allegedly, as they say, captured by the people they regulate. But if I were the Fed chairman, I would say that a bankrupt, devastated financial sector is a prelude to a depression. And so you may not give one whit of, you know, affection or enthusiasm or respect to a financial sector that's failed, but you got to get the banking system back on its feet so the rest of the economy doesn't go down the tubes with it. And I think that's the spirit in which some people at the Fed, rather than having, like I say, great affection for the financial sector, they just said it was inevitable. You got to bail them out, or we all, you know, they take us all hostage, and we go down with them.
Well, there was this extraordinary tape recordings made by a Fed employee, albeit one that didn't last very long there. It was on NPR's This American Life, that the tape recordings were pretty revealing of a culture of that's been captured by Wall Street. I mean, these Fed regulators were talking about how they were going to really slam Goldman Sachs bankers at a meeting. And then at the actual meeting that was recorded, they were total pussycats.
Mm-hmm. The woman's name was Carmen Segarra. And she was an employee there who essentially taped her own conversations. And she was someone who thought, and I think rightfully, that we should have been much tougher on the financial institutions that we were regulating. And her point of view was, we're currying favor with the people when the taxpayers are paying us to, which you might call, maintain the sobriety of the system. We're not getting there. And I think Elizabeth Warren is likely to hold some hearings on this. She tends to delve into these difficult and controversial things vis-a-vis the financial sector with what you might call great will and focus and dexterity. And so I think we'll probably learn more. But Carmen's perspective is probably what you might call revealing as to why we had the crisis in the first place. Prior restraint of financial institutions is not something that our regulators, whether it's the Fed, the Comptroller of the Currency, SEC, CFTC, nobody was on the beat for several years, what I'll call during the late Greenspan era. They were not vigilant in curtailing practices, and it was a kind of a Wild West time in the financial sector. But Carmen's tapes reveal how stressful it was trying to do the right thing inside the machine.
So just in general, though, Rob Johnson, do you it's pretty obvious that the U.S. taxpayer did not get value for money in bailing out Wall Street?
Well, once again, they didn't get value for money. The way you can look at that very simply is what Warren Buffett gave to Goldman Sachs was much more expensive than what weaker banks got from the American taxpayer as part of the TARP legislation. So, yes, they were given a lot of help. But as I said earlier, if you don't bail out the banking system when it goes over the cliff, then we're all going to suffer. So the question is, how do you be tough on them with preventive medicine so that they don't go over the cliff? And furthermore, when they do go over the cliff, like we saw in 2008, you have to put much tougher conditions on them. In other words, structural, systematic reforms than anything we saw emerging from Dodd-Frank.
And, of course, Dodd-Frank has been fought tooth and nail by the banking lobby, and they've managed to get all the Republicans on side and quite a number of Democrats. In fact, my understanding is that it's a prime slot for an ambitious congressman to get on the banking committee because the money just pours in.
Well, that's the problem. When the political system is unbridled in its need for money, then the financial sector gains tremendous power to what you might call make their own rules. And that is a great disservice to the population. I think if we had publicly financed elections and very strict rules on contributions, which you might call undermining what I'm being facetious, but the Supreme Court has called free speech, which is the free flow of money into politics, I think this has been disastrous, and it costs us. If you look at that financial crisis, it's cost us trillions of dollars in the United States and all over the world because of these malfunctions of governance that you've cited.
But what I find extraordinary is that it's not like the taxpayer got thanked by anybody. The banks are now even too big to fail, as has often been pointed out. And it seems like AEG is suing to get a better deal. I mean, has the lessons been learned anywhere on Wall Street?
Well, I think AIG feels that in order to bail out several other banks, some U.S. and some foreign, including French and German banks, they were used, and that their stockholders, because the vessel AIG, which made a lot of mistakes, was used as the vehicle to, what you might call, make everyone else whole and tear them up, that they paid a disproportionate price. And while I'm no fan of what happened at AIG's financial products, it was reckless and it was unregulated, and in many respects they deserve to be out of business. I do think that they were used as almost like a cover, like a mask, in order to channel money to others. And this lawsuit seems kind of odd because the guy who had run AIG, became the belly of the beast, is suing to recover something for himself when, at some level, you almost wish nobody had any compensation. But in relative terms, he may have an argument. That's what the courts will explore.
So, Rob Johnson, back to the Fed's announcement that it is ending its quantitative easing program in a day or so. And so far, $4.5 trillion has been spent to buy back bonds, which of course has, I think a lot of people assume that it's led to this extraordinary stock market that we have. So what's likely to happen? I mean, is there, what's easing the possibility of reckless trading and panic trading? I haven't noticed anything. I guess you pointed out earlier that it's not exactly that they haven't been signaling that this would happen, but you know, there is this potential, is there not, for people to go wild?
And I think in some ways the potential is going to be most violent in the emerging market countries, because these extraordinary low interest rates, which were well suited to the domestic financial traumas of the U.S. after the crash, were not really necessary in parts of Asia that were thriving and building and developing and in some cases booming. And what the Asians did, many of their big corporations, is they borrowed dollar bonds and then repatriated the money home. Well, now with the dollar getting stronger relative to other currencies, the what they call the carry trade, meaning the currency exposure of borrowing in hard currencies like the dollar with low interest rates and investing the money, say like in the Chinese renminbi, with high interest rates, that gets unwound. And I know a number of sophisticated investors, Kyle Bass in Texas and others, have been talking about the dangers of a, which you might call, currency unwind that could happen in the emerging markets, with stock and bond markets in those regions struggling as well. But the Fed is not unmindful of this. Stanley Fisher, the vice chairman who used to work with the IMF and is a very well known and seasoned international economist, just gave a speech at the Fed just a few days ago on the global implications of U.S. monetary policy. This is not like a bunch of people are, which you might call, flailing in the dark. They understand it's treacherous, they understand it's dangerous, they're moving slowly and they're communicating quite actively. But I would say it's a fragile circumstance, just as you suggest.
Well, just in closing, Rob Johnson, given the likelihood that the Republicans will take their Senate and increase their hold over the House in this midterm coming up next Tuesday, and we talked earlier about Dodd-Frank being under assault from the Republicans, Eric Cantor was Wall Street's best friend, promising to ease even more the few restrictions they are on commodities trading, etc. So we're likely to go into a much more permissive period under the Republicans. What I find extraordinary is that this will all happen because the Democrats won't come out to vote. And I guess my question to you may not be entirely related to finance is, what's wrong with the American left? Why aren't they showing up? I mean, why allow this country to go further to the right?
There's a cynical interpretation that the American left has ideas, but the American left's agenda doesn't create the money that's the mother's milk of politics. And so the fundraising on the right is rampant because essentially people are raising money and giving money to politicians in order to improve their return on investment. Whereas on the left, people are contributing smaller amounts of money because it's ideological. It's designed for a better nation. But I'd be a little bit careful about that. I think on both right and left, you have problems. And what you might call the more ideological left is often in combat with the business Democrats, what they call the Democratic Leadership Council in the old days, and the Robert Rubin wing of the party is a very different one than the Jeff Merkley or Elizabeth Warren wing of the party. And so I think you always see a great deal of tension within the Democratic Party, which weakens it vis-a-vis the Republicans. But what amazes me, I used to work for the Republican Party under Pete Domenici on the Senate Budget Committee, and I would like to see the Republicans come forward with a plan of how we rebuild this nation, increasing human capital, improving infrastructure, transportation. There's an awful lot to do to get America going again, and I don't see them doing anything other than trying to keep the tax bill down for wealthy people.
But I'm not suggesting that the American people should, the working Americans, the middle-class Americans, should falling down on their democratic duties by not giving money to the Democratic Party. What I'm puzzled about is why they simply won't even show up to vote. And this is, I think, we know what the results are going to be. They're going to be terrible for America.
Well, there are a whole lot of people. I'm using metaphor here. If you and I go to a restaurant and we have a bite to eat, if you walk in and there's nothing on the menu you want to order, you can leave the restaurant. Well, some people look at the ballot in a congressional election and they say both sides are totally bought by big money, wealthy people, corporate money. I have no interest in this game. Electoral politics is not an effective way of, which you might call, representing my human needs. And so they don't show. And I agree with you that that weakens the system, but I understand what you might call the logic of these individuals, too, because there's nothing they want to order from the menu of politicians that they see on their ballot.
Right, but there's a difference from being in a prison and being fed bologna sandwiches and being in a prison being tortured every day. I mean, I think we're heading for a very rough time because we know what these Tea Party people are about. And, you know, it'll be a long, long way back for the American people to undo the damage. That's the way I see it in any case.
You know? Well, I think you're right. And I travel a great deal internationally. I've just come back from Asia. From Korea and Hong Kong and China. And people are asking me over and over again, when will the United States reassert its world leadership? When will it get its economy back in shape? When will it stop squeezing its lower classes and which you might call investing in incarceration rather than education? And I don't have an answer for them that's particularly optimistic. I think we are in a bad spiral in America right now, and it is going to take a lot of will and a lot of energy and a lot of activism to get out of it.
Well, Robert Johnson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure. Talk soon.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and he's also a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute, and he served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz and was Chief Economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and the U.S. Budget Committee. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the impending sabotage by congressional hawks of the P5 plus one deal Obama's going to sign with Iran.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. Is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Trita Parsi, who's a co-founder and the president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. His latest article at Reuters is How Congressional Hawks Plan to Kill Obama's Iran Deal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you so much.
And the deal that is supposed to be the deadline for which is November the 24th, from what I hear from all kinds of sources, is that this is this deal of the P5 plus one and Iran is likely to happen, and it's going to be quite tectonic in its significance. But what you're warning about here is that the Congress still has time to sabotage it. So what are the hawks in Congress likely to do? We know that they hate Obama, and we also know that it looks as if the Republicans are going to take the Senate and take more of the House, so they'll be even stronger after November the 4th.
Correct. So here's the situation. There's a bit of a fabricated crisis over this allegation that these hawks have made in Congress that Obama is going to sideline Congress and make a deal with Iran. Well, reality is this. This is not a treaty that he's binding with Iran. As a result, there's no constitutional requirement for him to go to Congress. But Congress is nevertheless going to have a very important role in this, because as part of the deal, at some point, there's going to be lifting of sanctions through congressional action. So at that point, Congress will very much be involved. Here's the issue. The congressional hawks, by saying that Obama is trying to sidestep Congress, is trying to make sure that there is some sort of a vote on this matter in Congress very, very early. And the reason why they're doing this is because they know that Obama is going to try to come to Congress a bit later, perhaps a year and a half from now. Between now and a year and a half from now, what is likely to happen? Well, what they're afraid of is that the Iranians are going to live up to their end of the bargain, that they're going to do everything that they promised to do, and by the time the president goes to Congress and asks for a lifting of sanctions, so much positive has happened that poison has been taken out of the atmosphere and Congress will likely move forward to actually lift the sanctions. If you don't want to see a deal, if you prefer to get a military confrontation, you have a better chance if the vote is now, before the Iranians have had a chance to prove that they're actually living up to the end of the agreement. So the hawks are pushing for an early vote because they know that's the chance. That's how they will maximize their chances of shooting down Obama's deal with the Iranians.
But what motivates the hawks then? First of all, the U.S. in effect is acting as Iran's air force in Iraq. They're working together against the Islamic State. What is the, and I'm not sure that the military-industrial complex needs the continued enemy of Iran. They've got enough enemies in that region as it is. What is driving the hawks in Congress? Why don't they want to make a deal with Iran?
Well, first of all, let's make one thing clear. The hawks fear that if the deal goes forward and Congress waits before it takes action, more and more people who would be hawks today or who would be traveling along with the hawks would part ways with the hawks and go in favor of the deal. The only ones who would be remaining are the ones who actually want a military confrontation, who don't want to see a deal with Iranians, who fear that a deal with Iranians would put Israel in a bad situation, whose analysis of the situation is much closer to that of Bibi Netanyahu in Israel than that of the American intelligence community, and as a result are pushing to sabotage this at every turn. And right now they're trying to sabotage it by forcing an early vote in Congress.
But my understanding is that President Hassan Rouhani, he's been promising his people a bright economic future and that the middle class in Iran is chafing to rejoin the world. And there's enormous business opportunities in Iran, and that American businessmen see this. And there aren't too many places left where the U.S. I mean, first of all, the Chinese have been filling the gap during the sanction period in any case, in terms of consumer goods. But I don't understand, why the business community can't be rallied. My understanding is Iran is just desperate to join the world and to improve their economy. And there are all kinds of Iranian entrepreneurs chafing at the bit to form partnerships with American companies.
You're absolutely right. Everyone would win on this deal except the hawks, who want the war. The Iranians are more than eager to join the world economy. Their economy is actually a very sophisticated one. 80 million people, highly educated populace, demanding highly sophisticated American goods. And if we wait, the business community is going to get a chance to get organized and rally around this. Right now, the business community is keeping a very passive posture because prior to a deal being signed, they're not going to risk anything and come out on the side of pushing for sanctions to get lifted. Once there's a deal, however, I'm pretty confident that many of them are going to start putting in some of their weight onto this issue. And that's going to further isolate the Hawks and make it more and more and more difficult for them to be able to push through measures in Congress that would stop with the Washington deal and pave the way for war.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Trita Parsi, who's the co-founder and the president of the National Iranian American Council and author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. His latest article at Reuters is How Congressional Hawks Plan to Kill Obama's Iran Deal. And I might add that it's not just Obama's Iran deal we're talking about here. The P5 plus one are the permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, plus one being Germany. So it's most of the advanced world, economically speaking, that are behind this deal. So it's pretty extraordinary that it all comes down, from what I'm learning from you, Trita Parsi, is that it's more or less all comes down to Bibi Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister. That he has inordinate influence over the hawks in Congress, and they're acting as his surrogate. So let's get into the mind, if we can, of Bibi Netanyahu. Why is he so implacably opposed to this deal?
I think the big fear on the Israeli side is not tied to the nuclear program itself. In fact, the red line that Netanyahu has put forward, in which he said that Iran cannot reach 250 kilos of LEU, of higher 20% enriched LEU, is a red line that has been enforced, because the Iranians were at 190 kilos prior to the interim deal, and now they're down to, I think, pretty much close to zero. So the deal, the interim deal in and of itself, is actually taking care of this, and it's been a huge favor to Israel. Still, Netanyahu is complaining and putting up a major opposition to this. I think the key to this is that Netanyahu is very worried that post a deal on the nuclear issue, the U.S. and Iran will begin to collaborate in earnest against ISIS. And they will discover and take advantage of the fact that they have a lot of geopolitical interests in common. And that is going to reduce the significance, the influence of Israel in Washington, D.C. And that, I think, is something that is driving the Israelis, the fear of being abandoned by the United States and losing their geopolitical position.
Well, they also, I think, tied in with what you're just saying, is this anomaly that Israel and Saudi Arabia are for all intents and purposes allied. It is the Saudis who are funding and financing and directing the military coup in Egypt, which Israel, of course, is extremely happy about, this military government coming back. So are the Israelis and the Saudis working together? Because we know the Saudis are afraid. You will say the Israelis are afraid that they will be less significant once Iran and the U.S. get back together again. After all, our original agreement in that part of the world was with Iran. And so is this a case of Israel and Saudi Arabia being allied?
De facto, there is clearly not just coordination, but a bit more than just coordination. At his UN speech this time around, Bibi Netanyahu made it clear of how Israel and Saudi Arabia tend to see some of these things very similarly. And there were no objections coming from Saudi Arabia, UAE, or other Arab countries that Bibi Netanyahu actually mentioned by name. And that's a very interesting development, that both of these sides are very fearful of an idea of the U.S. and Iran stop being enemies.
So I would think, though, that if the American people understood these dynamics, particularly, I think, somewhere perhaps in their subconscious, they know how the Saudis have been two-faced forever. After all, they helped create Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, and the Islamic State. And, you know, at some point or other, I think we got to ask ourselves who our true friends are and who our real enemies are.
Well, that's precisely what they're fearing. That's exactly what I was pointing to earlier on. That if there is a deal between the United States and Iran, the United States' maneuverability in the region will increase. Its dependence on some of its current allies can reduce. I'm not saying that it will reduce, but it can reduce. And question marks about who of the friends actually have aligned interests right now will become much more pertinent. I think already prior to the deal, we're starting to see the signs of this. just today, The Atlantic published an article by Jeffrey Goldberg in which he reveals that numerous Obama administration officials have been telling journalists, apparently with the intent of having them print this, that they call Bibi Netanyahu, and I quote, a chicken, and that they've called his bluff. Israel cannot bomb Iran. They're not going to fall for the threat that it might bomb Iran if the United States doesn't do what Israel wants it to do with Iran. And the article declares that the crisis between the Israelis and the Americans at this point is officially on, that this is no longer some minor tensions. This is some form of a crisis in relations. And much of it is around Iran, but it's not limited to that. And Iran, of course, is the symbol or the indication of the shifting geopolitical situation in the region.
So what could happen then if indeed all of the neighbors of Iraq, and including the United States, are still sticking to the delusion that Iraq is still a country? And we know the Kurds have gone their way, and it seems unlikely that that country will ever be a unitary state again, but none of the neighbors want it to break up. But inevitably, it would seem to me that the Shiite part of Iran in the south will end up very much in Iran's orbit, where it clearly already is. Could you end up with a situation where Iran, in effect, would have influence over Iraq's oil? And if you combine the oil in Iraq and in Iran, that would make them more powerful in terms of oil reserves than Saudi Arabia. At the moment, it's the Saudis who are pumping oil frantically to drop the price to put more pressure on Iran. So can the tables be turned?
It certainly can. I think the Iranians already have a tremendous amount of influence in Iraq. I think if Iraq were to fall apart, it would actually be a negative for the Iranians, because they wield a lot of influence over all of Iraq right now, whereas they would be reduced to parts of Iraq if this deal were to, if Iraq were to fall apart. Incidentally, I've spoken to several Israelis who believe that it would be a good thing for them if both Iraq and Syria fall apart. It will cut off Iran's link to the Levant. But I think they're missing on the point that if Syria and Iraq fall apart and it's going to be turned into a number of smaller states, that in and of itself actually makes Iran a relatively larger giant in the region.
So I guess this is a case of staying tuned, but we have to see what happens obviously next week with the elections. And a lot will rest with how much Obama becomes a lame duck and how much he can stand up to the hawks in Congress.
True. I think if you have a Republican Senate, you're going to have a much tougher time for the president to be able to wield influence with the Congress. And that's going to actually make it more difficult for a deal to be struck. Because if the Iranians don't believe that Obama has the ability to deliver on his end of the bargain, they're not going to strike a bargain.
Well, Dr. Tridipasi, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Tridipasi, who's the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. His latest article at Reuters is How Congressional Hawks Plan to Kill Obama's Iran Deal. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into massive demonstrations in Hungary against a proposal to tax the internet. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kim Lane Shapil, who is a professor of sociology and international affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School and the University Center for Human Values, as well as director of the program in law and public affairs at Princeton University. From 1994 to 1998, she lived in Budapest doing research at the Constitutional Court of Hungary and teaching at both the University of Budapest and at Central European University, where she was a founding director of the program in gender and culture. After 1989, Shapil studied the emergence of constitutional law in Hungary and Russia, living in both places for extended periods. Her latest book is The International State of Emergency, The Rise of Global Security Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kim Lane Shapil.
Hi, very nice to talk to you. And actually, my last name is Shapil.
Shapil, I'm sorry. Shapil.
Hard to guess from the spelling.
Okay, Shapil. Okay, so I'm sorry. These demonstrations in all across Hungary, hundreds of thousands of people are taken to the streets. Tossing old computer parts at the headquarters of the ruling party, and they're furious with this right-wing prime minister who is apparently has, I guess we could call them authoritarian tendencies, Viktor Orban. And we've spoken before about this, how right-wing and how dangerous this government is in Hungary. It looks as though, even though this guy's been re-elected recently with a tremendous majority, it looks as though the demonstration is cutting right across the political lines here. So is he in any kind of trouble?
Well, it's a little early to tell whether he's in trouble, but one of the things I found really fascinating in kind of listening in on these demonstrations is that people who are in the streets actually feel like something has really changed. One of the reasons why Viktor Orban won the parliamentary election back in April, and then his party also got victories in the European election and then the municipal elections. A lot of that was because he had changed all the rules for the election so that he couldn't lose. Also, even though he got two-thirds of the seats in the parliament, he did so only getting 45% of the vote, and that was in a population where more than a third of the people stayed home. So, you know, if you look at the number of people who really voted for Orban, or the percentage of the population that voted for Orban, it's only 25% or so. So, you know, he looks like he's got this landslide, but actually he's quite vulnerable because the rest of the, you know, the majority of people who voted did not vote for his party, and a third of the voters just stayed home. So all of that means that, you know, he doesn't have this overwhelming support that he looks like he has from the outside. He was waiting until these three elections were over. The last one was just over a couple of weeks ago. And then he said he was promising big changes. And no one knew what the changes were because, of course, his party didn't run on a platform or anything so pedestrian as that. So he's just come out with this whole package of taxes and economic, you know, sort of economic measures because the government is running a large budget deficit. And they're trying very hard to avoid coming under review from the European Union. So this giant package of taxes had small print, you know, way back in the document that suddenly said there was going to be this tax on gigabytes of internet use. And so it took about a week for that to become kind of flagged. And then there was a guy who hasn't previously been all that involved in politics before who set up a Facebook page protesting this. And within a short period of time, he had, you know, I think that the total today is 230,000 likes. This is a country of 10 million people, or maybe 9.5 million, because a lot of folks have left in the last few years. But, you know, 230,000 likes is a lot, and it turns out that it's a lot more likes on Facebook than the Facebook page of the governing party. You know, so this could be huge. This could really be huge. And the people who were out in the crowds this week, back-to-back demonstrations, the last of which may have had as many as 100,000 people, the people out in the streets are saying something really feels like it's changed. So it's always hard to guess the future, and particularly with respect to Viktor Orban, who always fights back. But, you know, it does really seem for the first time like there's a mobilized opposition out in the streets.
Well, this is Viktor Orban. We've talked about him before, and the European Parliament has been extremely sceptical of his and his actions, trying to take over the courts, taking over the Parliament, going after the gypsies and minorities, and exhibiting all of the worst that we thought we'd gotten rid of after World War II, all of that, the sort of nasty era of the 1930s in Europe, and this is a phenomenon across Eastern Europe, at least. He just happens to have taken a country with this, with these very toxic and very troubling politics.
Yeah, well, but here too, again, the context matters. So, so it turns out that when Viktor Orban was elected in 2010. There was kind of a foul mood in the country because the socialists, which is the main, Fidesz is the main left party and the socialists are the main right party. The socialists had been running things for 8 years, and on their watch, the economy fell apart. So Hungary went from kicking along at about 4% GDP growth every year until suddenly the financial crisis hit Hungary about a year before it hit the rest of the world. And so Hungary went from having a plus 4 GDP growth to having suddenly a contraction of 7%. I mean, a huge, 10-11% change in the overall change of GDP felt like the bottom fell out of everything. And right after that, there was an election. So Orban came to power in the middle of this financial crisis when the only other party that could have won the election, namely the socialists, were really, shall we say, not looking particularly good, both because of the crisis and also because of a lot of corruption corruption charges. And so Fidesz kind of came in with this landslide in 2010, not so much because people were voting for bringing back the 1930s, you know, or bringing back what has become a kind of, you know, really shocking public anti-Semitism and rewriting of Holocaust history, in addition to really punitive policies against the Roma or the Gypsy minority. All of that is happening too, but I'm not convinced that that vote for Orban in 2010 was a vote for intolerance. You know, there are certainly people in his party and people in another political party called Jobbik, which is to the right of Fidesz, that certainly have been whipping up this kind of public sentiment, and that's very much dominated the public space, the public conversation in the last 4 years. But I don't think that this is really a majority of the Hungarian population. You know, I think Orban came to power at a very difficult moment when it would have been impossible for any government to have held on to its majority, and he was the main opposition party. And he used the fact that he got this landslide in 2010 to entrench his power in all kinds of ways. I mean, he rewrote the Constitution. He basically, you know, has now really threatened the independence of the judiciary. His party has taken over every single independent institution in the country. There's literally no public body in Hungary left that is in the hands of an opposition party. And so what's interesting is that, you know, when autocrats shut down the democratic space, they lose their ability to keep track of what the public will and will not handle. And I think this internet tax is really an example of this idea that these guys are sitting there in a bubble trying to figure out what they can tax next. Because, of course, the markets have responded, and markets, foreign investors, and lots of people who can move have responded to these changes by really shutting down all investment in Hungary. And so, you know, the economy has been weakening. The Orban government, in its first term, taxed everything that they could, you know, banks, energy, telecom, retail sectors. They taxed they nationalized the private pension system and used everybody's savings to plug budget holes. They put a tax on currency conversions as well as on every single time you take cash out or pay for something on a credit card, the government takes a piece of it. You know, these huge taxes that went into effect, in the first term, just because they are in such a budget crisis. So they're looking around for something else to tax because all their special taxes didn't really fill the budget hole because the economy is still crumbling. And so so they came out with a whole package of taxes, like I said, and this internet tax was buried in the bunch of them. and this internet tax has really struck a nerve. I might say, just to, on a comparative point, that in 2010, there were huge demonstrations in the former Soviet Republic, now independent state of Kyrgyzstan. And the thing that brought protesters out into the street in Kyrgyzstan in 2010 was a government tax on text messages. Now, this was another context where the government had been ticking along, being corrupt and not particularly well-liked, and, you know, all the kinds of things you could also say about Hungary. But the thing that brought people out into the streets in Kyrgyzstan in 2010 was a tax on text messages. And so now we've got this tax on the internet in Hungary, and it's brought, you know, really unprecedented numbers of people out into the streets. And, you know, that in Kyrgyzstan, it toppled the government. So that's why I'm saying, you know, you just don't know what's going to happen here, because when you really mobilize a lot of people who feel like, you know, enough is enough, it's hard to know where this is going to stop.
But how do we put this in the context of this, we know about the emergence of right-wing parties throughout Eastern Europe and in Western Europe, too, and it's alarmed a lot of people. And most people say it's a condition of a deteriorating economy that all this nasty stuff comes out of the woodwork. But we also have what's been going on in Ukraine recently, where there you've essentially had a criminal government supported by another criminal government in Russia, the Putin administration, which is a massive kleptocracy run by the so-called Siloviki, all of the former intelligence people who are Putin's cronies who sort of regulate the oligarchs and shake them down. And it, you know, they're using all kinds of force to they've taken Crimea and they're intimidating Ukraine. So it's as though you've got these really unpleasant models out there in post-Cold War politics of a kind of gangster capitalism in Russia, and these emerging right-wing throwbacks to the 1930s that also, I mean, Hitler was a gangster capitalist too, after all. So
right. Well, exactly. And so, you know, one thing to remember about the 1930s was that, you know, Hitler's party was called the National Socialists, right? And so there was a kind of sense in the 1930s that, you know, capitalism had run amok and that these were two different kinds of reactions, you know, both the sort of Soviet communist experiment and the fascist experiment in Germany, also Italy, you know, were reactions against that kind of sort of runaway, unregulated capitalism. And that's partly what's happening now, because when the bottom falls out of an economy, people start to think, you know, there have to be alternatives to the market. What's happening in Hungary is a really bizarre mashup of left and right politics, as conventionally understood. So on one hand, the Orbán government is whipping up nationalist sentiment as a way of attracting voter support. And it does this by, you know, looking back to Hungary's great, looking back to the time that Hungary was independent before it was taken under the wing, shall we say, of the Soviet Union after the Second World War. The last time Hungary was independent before it renewed its independence in 1989 was in this interwar period when it had come out from under the Austro-Hungarian Empire and before it went into the Soviet one. And during that time, there was a leader who stayed in power for the entire period between those two events, almost the entire period between those two events, who was constantly trying to whip up the sense of Hungarian greatness by, of course, you know, introducing anti-Semitic laws and persecuting the Roma. And that's what that period was, you know, very much motivated by. So Orban's going back to that period saying, you know, before communism, there was this great Hungarian moment, and I'm going to restore that for you, right? So he's relying on this very specific set of dog whistle references to the interwar period in Hungary. But also, because he's in this budget crisis, you know, he's really, and this is the thing that may well destabilize his government, because there's simply not enough cash. So one of the things Orban's been doing, in addition to raising all these taxes, is he's actually kind of sidled up to and cozied in with Russia. Now, this is really bizarre because Orban ran for election in 2010 as Mr. Anti-Communist. And by anti-communist, he was pulling up, again, a whole series of references from the communist period in Hungary, you know, between 49 and 89. And those references were, you know, the anti-communism means anti-Russia in all kinds of ways in Hungary. But Orban needed cash. So what he's been doing is he's been going around hat in hand to whatever dodgy dictatorships will have him, and looking for ways to subsidize the Hungarian economy. So he made a big deal with China. He's been going to Kazakhstan, Saudi Arabia, Turkmenistan this summer, no less. The president of Turkmenistan came to Hungary. He's been looking, Azerbaijan is another country he's tried to court. And finally, in the end, he went to Russia. And the Russians were quite happy to help out Hungary. And so the Russians gave Hungary a $23 billion loan to be used to rebuild Hungary's nuclear power infrastructure with the help of Russian technology and Russian nuclear fuel, actually. This deal was concluded in January, actually before the election, and it was sort of surprising to me that the opposition wasn't able to make more out of the fact that suddenly Orban had done this huge deal with Russia. But the question is, you know, so why was Russia so eager to do this? And, you know, since the election, I think we may have some answer. And that is that Orban, Mr. Anti-Communist, has been siding with Russia in all of these disputes where the EU and Russia are on different sides. So, for example, when the annexation of Crimea happened, Orban was in there saying, well, you know, we should promise autonomy for the Hungarians in Ukraine.
I'm afraid we're running out of time here. I don't mean to cut you off, but you've made the point that he's definitely voting against the rest of Europe in favor of what Putin is basically telling him. So,
I
think we should watch this country, and not a lot of attention is paid to it. And I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. And please watch Hungary. Yes,
I will. Thank you again. Again, I've been speaking with Kim Lane Shepperly, who's a professor of sociology and international affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School and the University Center for Human Rights, as well as a director of the program in law and public affairs at Princeton University. From 1994 to 1998, she lived in Budapest doing research at the Constitutional Court of Hungary and teaching at both the University of Budapest and at Central European University, where she was a founding director of the program in gender and culture. After 1989, Shepperly studied the emergence of constitutional law in Hungary and Russia, living in both places for extended periods. And her latest book is The International State of Emergency, The Rise of Global Security Law. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.